I call the meeting of the Energy, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 26, 2026, and we have a quorum present. Rep. Sexton, would you like to move the minutes for February 24th?
I would.
Representative Sexton moves the February 24th minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The next item of business is a presentation from former Administrative Law Judge Eric Lippman to tell us about his experience with rate cases. Judge Lippman, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed when you are ready.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, members. My name is Eric Lippman, and until December of last year, I was an administrative law judge with the Court of Administrative Hearings. I served on that court for 19 years, doing the kind of rate cases that set natural gas and electricity rates for your constituents. There are four key takeaways for members from my presentation, but before I get into the slides, I just wanted to take a moment to describe a little bit more about my background and how I came to learn the things that I want to share with you today. In state government, I'm what they call a 30-year man. Across a number of different assignments, I worked for three decades for the state of Minnesota. I cared deeply about this state and really dedicated my professional life to try and improve the way that it functions and it operates. I'm really proud to be a Minnesotan. And it occurred to me that before I began today, maybe it's because I can't hold down a job, I've literally done almost every assignment in this room. Legislative assistant, researcher, agency staff, gubernatorial staff, member, vice chairman. And so across all of those different assignments, I'm someone who, like I said, dedicated my professional life to try and make things better than the way I found it. And that's why I'm here today, okay? All of that is a long way of saying I'm just like you. I care about our state institutions more than most things. That background, I think, is important because the things that I'm going to talk about today, the things I'm going to describe, the arguments that I'm going to make, they're going to hurt some feelings. Some people are going to feel unduly attacked or criticized because I have some concerns about how state government is operating and how it's treating the poorest constituents in each of your districts, the poorest ratepayers. That's who I'm concerned about. And again, it was quite uncomfortable in December of this past year, where I literally burned my Hanukkah card list, my Christmas card list, down to the studs. I'm not really all that welcome in the public utilities law section anymore. I'm probably a pariah amongst my former colleagues a little bit because of the things that I've been saying about rate regulation in the state of Minnesota. They're quite, you know, they're fairly controversial, I admit that. But I think that they're actually true. And when it came time for choosing, and all of us have time for choosing, when I was thinking about this and whether I would lead state government this past autumn, and I did, I was reminded that members, both House and Senate, when talking about the situation with feeding our future, said, oh boy, we wish that folks in state government who knew about problems with how our state government is operating would have had the courage to come forward and to say the uncomfortable things out loud, even if it was an implied criticism or an overt criticism of how their work colleagues were operating. There are some things that are more important, and I entirely agree. So, again, notwithstanding the fact that I have fewer friends today than I did last autumn, I feel better about passing myself in the mirror in the morning when I have to shave, because I really care about the poorest ratepayers. And when I was an administrative law judge, we would hear from folks in public hearings, I can't afford the 6% increase. I can't afford the rate increase of 8% or 10% or whatever it's going to be. I think government and how it is operating is, in fact, reducing access to services and pricing people in ways that make access to electricity and some of the horrible choices. I have to choose between medicine or groceries and the electricity bill that I'm facing. That's horrible. That's not something that state government should contribute to, and I think it does. At least that's the argument I'm going to try to make to you today. So There are four key takeaways, as I suggested. There's been a sharp rise in the amount of government expenses that are charged by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to your ratepayers. The MPUC's assessments to ratepayers, in my view, is the most regressive tax we have here in Minnesota. It has your poorest constituent ratepayers in the draftiest houses paying more of the government expenses than folks like me who live in an energy efficient home. Why? Because the government expenses are put on a per therm basis for natural gas and a kilowatt basis to electricity rates. So if you have an energy inefficient home, and we all know that energy efficiency is correlated to rises in income, folks who are richer tend to live in more energy efficient homes, that this operates as a regressive tax on the poor. And it became intolerable to me. I didn't want to be a part of this system or have to pretend when I was on the bench listening to folks struggling to pay these bills that I really didn't care or that I didn't do all that I could to try and remediate that situation. How that works is there's a two-fifths formula that is assigned, and again, no fault of the PUC, it's in statute 216B.62, that gives the PUC the ability to charge more in agency expenses, 4 cents more, for every $10 it awards to the utilities that come before it and ask for a rate increase. So, for example, Xcel Energy is now petitioning for a $63 million increase in revenue for natural gas services. If that happens, I'm not saying it will, but if that happens, that would be like dropping off a suitcase full of $250,000 to the MPUC. They swear up and down they don't, in fact, want the situation. They don't want that suitcase full of $250,000, but it arrives because of the operation of the statute, whether they like it or not. And I think, as I'll argue in the handout on the cases, I've cited four cases, three Supreme Court cases and one Circuit Court case that suggests that there are significant due process concerns if you have an agency that is making decisions that is, in fact, has a financial interest or a financial benefit from the decisions it makes. I think it makes for an intolerable situation not only for the commission but for my former court. They're not business partners. They're supposed to be neutrals. They're supposed to be detached. And the statute, with regret, again, I don't think it's intentional, but with regret, makes them co-venturers. And I think the other piece that is regrettable for the poorest ratepayers in your district is that, unlike the State Board of Investment, the MPUC uses lawyers and litigation in order to make key policy choices. The State Board of Investment uses market-based metrics. And as someone who was a former deputy to Secretary Kiffmeyer and served on SBI State Board of Investment committees, the work that the SBI does with $160 billion worth of pension portfolios is just as complicated as the $7.6 billion of rate regulation that the Public Utilities Commission. It's not an order of magnitude difficult. They're very similar, as I'll make clear. So let's get into it and how it happens, because I do want to be respectful of time. So here are the budget pages. I'm a former appropriator and member of finance committees, was a conferee on omnibus bills. These are the most remarkable budget pages I've ever seen because they don't have parentheses. They arrive at committee, and for the new members of the committee, I particularly wanted to make a special mention. Here the PUC comes in, and it's like, great, you know, you're not asking for general fund money. Or if you're asking for general fund money, it's an appropriation with air quotes. But they're going to pay, as they say in the background information, they're going to pay all of that money back. So the fiscal note is great. If you're an agency, you know, we're not really causing you anything. You're not in the scrum of the other agencies trying to fight for your piece of the targets. You've got your own funding mechanism, which is entirely separate. The problem with that they don't tell you is that it goes on a per therm basis to the poorest constituent in the most regressive tax. I think it's, in fact, harmful. I was fiscal conservative when I was a member. I would not want a situation of funding the PUC in this way because it's so harmful to regular ratepayers. And it's a 60% increase that has allowed them in the last 2 years to add 27 additional employees. It's real dollars and a real impact. I think it's also optically bad for the commission because, as I've excerpted right here, this is a page from the notice and order for hearing in that natural gas case I talked about. For cost of gas, cost of distribution, customer service, administrative and general expense, if Xcel had a 60% increase, the PUC would send them to a trial. There's going to be 10 months of litigation over the propriety of these expenses. So I think that by the PUC's own standards, this committee should take an active role in exploring how these dollars are spent and whether they should be assessed to the very poorest in your district. So here's 216B62. I'll just highlight the statute briefly. You can see in that second red box the two-fifths of 1%, that's a very small number, two-fifths of 1%, 0.004, but it's multiplied against a very large number, which is the gross operating income of your 9 rate-regulated utilities. Again, we're not at a position where the PUC is charging $30 million worth of expenses in order to decide, among other things, what rates are charged, but that's where we're headed, and that's what the statute right now, as of today, would permit. I think it's an intolerable situation. I think these kinds of expenses to the poorest are also intolerable, and I'd encourage folks to think about it. What would the PUC say about this? Well, Secretary Bull told you last week, hey, we've taken $1 billion out of the system because of the way that we do things, and our rates, or at least our electricity rates, are in the bottom decile of all 50 states. We're in the lowest five, which is where we want to be. I think those arguments, in fact, raise more questions than they do, in fact, answer. The $1 billion number is a comparison with what the utility filed in its application. Hi, PUC, we'd like this extra amount in money with what actually happens at the end of 10 months of litigation, what the PUC actually awards. I think that's a phony baloney number. I call it the MSRP problem. If you're going into an auto dealership and you want to buy a new automobile, the manufacturer's suggested retail price is X. Let's say it's, I don't know, a new Ford truck, $30,000. No consumer, very few, pay the MSRP price. And it allows the dealership to say, oh, no, I'm giving you much less than the dealership price, or at least the MSRP price, because the dealership price is lower, and I'm passing the savings on to you. I think that that's the problem in the comparison. Only the most naive and guileless consumer would say, oh, no, I saved off of the MSRP, I saved a boatload of money. No, it's a phony baloney figure. That was never going to be the price of the car in the first place. I think that's the same thing here. Their initial bid for Xcel, by way of an example, in its application, they know that they're not going to end up at that number. They know that they're going to have 10 months of really expensive litigation fighting about that number. It's, I think, artificially high. I wouldn't compare the, quote, savings that you make over that. And it also assumes that there isn't any other way other than 10 months of grinding litigation in order to get that lower number. If you know that you want to be in the bottom decile of electricity rates, for example, as Secretary Bull said last week, great. Why not make that the standard? Why do we need a trial? You know where you wanted to end up as far as the price point, and that's what matters. There are also, as I said, significant due process concerns. I think it undermines the validity and the legitimacy of the process. Again, you can look at the four cases I've decided. Here are cases of tribunals and administrative boards that had an active financial interest benefited from the decisions that they make. It's improper. We've got to change the system because, again, no fault of their own, but it is corrupting, and I think it's inappropriate. So are you paying for one dozen lawyers or two today? That's the question that we've had over the last 9 rate cases. You know, between 13 at the bottom and 24 at the top, we are over-lawyered. In the Xcel rate case that I talked about, 8 lawyers on behalf of Xcel across 3 law firms in order to answer the questions of what is just and reasonable rates. I think that's too many, particularly because most of these lawyers that I've charted here are charging your constituents these enormous bills. And I would suggest to you that the downtown law firms that Xcel Energy has hired not all that affordable. We're not talking about the public defender service here involved in rate making. We're talking about the most talented, most expensive lawyers in the state billing simultaneously. So you have 18 or 20 or 24 hourly rates going at the same time, all on to your poorest constituents. I think it's a scandal. I think it's inappropriate. Is there an alternative? I think there is. It occurs to me that as a state pensioner and also an XL customer for Natural Gas and Electricity Service, I'm in fact served by two different state agencies. From the State Board of Investment, I get great service. They allow me to pay those higher electricity and natural gas bills because of the way that they manage my state contributions and they manage my pension. $160 billion worth of a portfolio. They're wonderful people. And in fact, they have a very similar budget and very similar staff complement to the PUC. And yet they're 20 times the regulatory reach. They're able to do 20 times the kind of regulation and regulatory oversight that the PUC. Why? Because they don't use lawyers. They get knowledgeable volunteers in the Investment Advisory Committee. They use market metrics. What's the beta risk? What's the alpha risk of this particular investment? What are you against your proxy group? How do you do against the S&P? These are all available for either a Wall Street Journal subscription or, tuning into MSNBC. You can see these kinds of metrics. They're widely available to people, and they're really affordable. They don't require hourly rates of teams of lawyers. That's not how we do financial oversight with the PUC. And the expenses are being borne by each and every one of us. I think we need to change the system, and we can. What I'm talking about is not science fiction. Obviously, it's not very far from Empire Drive to East 7th Street. Those folks can, in fact, talk to each other. And also, I think it's important to say that for 10 years, we will celebrate the 10th year that the Minnesota legislature 10 years ago, it will celebrate in June when that bill became effective, have performance-based rate making. Now, in April of this year, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission is going to decide whether it even continues thinking about doing this in any other way. In fact, there's a significant suggestion that they're going to have the utility stop doing performance-based reporting about how we could do this in another way and abandon the enterprise, notwithstanding that very helpful statute, the MPUC is going to give up. It seems to like its lawyers and is not really looking for a situation out of this situation. I think that they need some nudging and oversight and some hard questions from the members of this committee and the members of the legislature because it has a real-world impact. If I could use the example of the vice chairman's district, Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff said last week that access to natural gas is correlated to energy burden. If you're more likely to have access to natural gas service, you're less likely to be energy burdened. His, on this chart, the vice chairman's district is among the bluest in the state, the most energy burdened. And if you want to explore why that is the case, I'll give you my theory and also a test that I hope that members will undertake. It's called the two beer test. And if you don't drink beer, that's fine. The beers are not for you. I'm asking each member in their own time to find a member who works for, or a member of the public who works for a rate-regulated utility that's regulated at the municipal level, less than 5,000 customers in natural gas. And there are such companies that are operating around the state. And after the two beers, maybe when they're singing to the jukebox music, maybe they're enjoying themselves and feel a little bit more comfortable, you ask them the key question. Are you guys looking forward to expanding your business beyond 5,000 customers? It's my prediction that they will say no and hell no. And you have to ask them why. Well, because now we're going to be subject to the crazy town that is a regulation downtown with the PUC. It means all sorts of lawyers and regulatory expenses that we just don't want to bear. And it's really hard for a small company to do just that. So if local natural gas companies are not growing, as I am suggesting to you that they aren't, that means more energy burden. There are places that could be receiving natural gas service We draw them off of more expensive propane and home heating oil, and in some cases, God forbid, wood, you know, as far as a home heating solution, and give them a PHMSA-regulated natural gas pipeline that's a third of the price that they're paying, you know, for home heating oil or for propane. I think it's a moral issue. It was one so troubling to me, again, that I was inspired to quit. If I'm right about that, we can do a lot about energy burden by expanding access to natural gas service, but we first have to do regulatory reform because those folks don't, in fact, want to grow their business beyond 5,000 customers. Super problematic and I think harmful. And it's something, again, I hate saying it out loud, but it really does need to be said because there are people in your districts that are suffering with these bills. And I think, at least in part, we as state agency officials or Minnesotans are part of that problem. And so with that, I'm grateful for the members' time and I'm delighted to answer any questions and to yield to the mic to the other business.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I think it's really interesting. I also agree that we do have an issue here, right, and that it hits everywhere. It hits in rural Minnesota. It hits home, where I represent in St. Paul.
Absolutely.
But I think where maybe I am a little confused is we're pointing towards the regulatory body of the PUC and saying that it's at fault, but we know that you're in XL territory. I'm in XL territory. We know that the people in XL get paid millions and millions of dollars, right? It is a for-profit company. We know that they're the ones hiring the lawyers to argue their point. We know that that goes back to our ratepayers, which is, you know, I would argue unfair when people are making millions of dollars and my folks are living in poverty. And so I guess thinking about this, I tend to put the blame more on the utility companies because we do have a system in place, but I do feel like that system has been exploited because utilities have money to exploit that system, right? I mean, I championed the intervener compensation bill a couple of years ago because I felt like regular people, regular organizations, nonprofits didn't have the ability to compete with, to your point, dozens of lawyers. And so my question to you is, so two-part question, I guess, finally. I get to my question after, you know, politicians, we talk.
I'm a former member.
Right, you know.
Mr. Chair.
So I guess my question is, you know, who's really at blame here? The system that exists or the utilities that have, utilities, exploited that system because they can? And then the second question is, you mentioned how your pension is well-run. Well, then why are we not exploring the idea of having a public power utilities, because if your pensions are well run, maybe, and there's a monopoly, right? We don't have a choice in who we're going to take on as our power provider. Why not have something that is run to the benefit of the people without the expectation of profit? Because we know that power is something that everybody needs. So two questions.
Okay. Judge Littman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hollins, thanks so much for those questions. With respect to who's at blame, I guess I would say because I'm a 30-year man and a poli-sci major and a G-man in every respect, I was focused on my expertise, where I can contribute and make better. I focus on what the government is doing. Is that the entire solution to the problem? Absolutely not. It's not. But I think it's really hard for when the government isn't really minding its expenses, in my estimation, and is contributing to the problem, that really, at least at a moral level, I think it's forfeit to say, you know, you private companies, you know, you're raking these folks over the coals. It may well be, okay, that that's in fact happening. I think that there's a solution to that, which is to hold them to the market standard. Again, maybe this is more controversial, but it's my view. I really don't care what they pay Xcel's CEO. Okay, that's a controversial position. Let me tell you why, okay? Because when I was a judge, the folks who would come before us, the ratepayer saying we can't afford this, would talk about five things, one of five things. I did this for 19 years. There was no exception. There were only about these five things. It was access to the service, safety of the service, reliability of the service, the responsiveness after failure, and smooth inclining rates. That's what the customers want. I think all of this kabuki theater over pension expense or G&A or salaries or whatever, who cares? As long as we get electricity rates in the bottom five of, you know, whatever the standard is that Secretary Bull would set, as long as we get that price point as far as the price and the access, safety, reliability, responsiveness, and I think those are all five of those five things. If we have performance metrics on those things, why do we care how they run? And I certainly don't want to hire lawyers, teams of lawyers, dozens of lawyers, to explore the inner workings. The other thing is I think we have to have some modesty about the Public Utilities Commission's ability to oversee and run a complex enterprise like Xcel Natural Gas. Or even the Department of Commerce. I don't think they have the expertise. Of the five commissioners that are now serving out, they're all fine people, lovely people, but only one of them has ever served a day in their life, an hour of work life, for a public utility. They're not in a position to run a public utility, okay? And even Commissioner Partridge, she was sort of a middle manager. She wasn't the C-suite person that you're talking about. And these are enormously complicated enterprises. In last year, there are more people that retired from Xcel's natural gas operations in Minnesota than actually work for the Department of Commerce. These are really wildly different operations, and I think we have to approach with some modesty and not to say, oh, no, we're smarter, or the folks in the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission know better how to run Xcel than the Xcel leadership. I don't think that's true. What we do know, and how the SBI approaches this, doesn't matter. I don't have to be a fund manager. I don't have to be smarter than Wall Street. I just have to measure their performance against the commonly accepted metrics that Wall Street runs by. I want a similar kind of regime here. Let's take those costs out of the system and do the kinds of policy choices, which is where do you want rates to end up? That's something absolutely within the expertise of former Senator Sieben and my colleague, who I sat two seats away from on the House floor, Commissioner Tuma. They can actually absolutely do that. Can they run Xcel? Would I want them to take over the presidency of Xcel? No, I don't think so, because I just don't think they have the background or expertise.
Representative Hollins, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my question then is, if we did have a state-run utility, why would we not hire people who knew how to do it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hollins, forgive me if I didn't address that point. I actually was...
Judge Lippman, sorry. I was talking.
I was actually quite interested in I think it was Tuesday's testimony about virtual power plants, Representative Kraft's bill. I think that those are innovative solutions. In that space, I'm sort of all of the above. I wouldn't, be opposed to kind of exploring that. I want to do whatever it is we can to take costs out of the system. If Representative Hollins, your view about a public actor in this space rather than having, a private, I'm all ears. I'd like to listen. Can we, in fact, get SBI-level services from rate-regulated utilities? That's where we need to go. I'm agnostic, all of the above, in the ways of taking costs out of the system. Again, it's not about me. Certainly not about my reputation. It's about the poor people who are suffering and can't pay this bill. That's who I want to serve.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lippman, a couple of comments and a question. I'm finding it hard to understand exactly what you're proposing. But I will point out, I think, right, what you're saying is the way the PUC charges its expenses, because it happens on a per-therm basis, it's regressive tax on the poor. And I think you'd say the same thing about then just energy costs, because they're done on a per therm basis, right? So to the extent we can do more efficiency and maybe programs, and which by the way, utilities do some programs to lower energy burden on the, so I don't think it's any different than that. Are you saying that you want less oversight of the utilities or different kind of oversight? And then,
Judge Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kraft, thank you so much. I think I want different kinds of oversight. I want SBI-style oversight, which is to use market-based metrics, again, to make the policy choices. Where do we want to be on safety? Where do we want to be on reliability? I think we can express the outcomes that we want from the system and not necessarily have the kind of bleak house and very expensive litigation that we have. I mean, How I got into this was the experience of the smallest rate-regulated utility, Greater Minnesota Gas. It went to the Department of Commerce this past summer and said, or maybe it was earlier in the spring last year, what is just and reasonable rates? What is your number? And the Department of Commerce official that they were talking to said, damned if we know. Well, they're the Department of Commerce. If they don't know where they want to end up, it's going to be really super expensive to try and get there. And it is. And it's really hard. Again, Greater Minnesota Gas only has 11,000 customers. You know, they're slightly above the 5,000. There were more government officials, and with regret, to my eternal shame, I was one of them, there were more government officials billing against that file than there were employees of the company. The regulators literally outnumbered the regulated. That's a scandalous situation. I didn't want to be a part of it. I don't think you guys should either. We really need to change this system. It needs to be different. I certainly want vigorous oversight, but I think we can do it a lot cheaper, and that's where the conversation should be. How can we get more bang for this buck because it matters to poor people?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Judge Lippman. A point, and then I'm actually would like, if the PUC is here, to come, I'd like to hear their thoughts on what your testimony. One of the things you said, actually, I have a strong philosophical difference with you on. You were talking about the PUC. I think that the PUC commissioners, because they don't have experience, or they haven't run a utility or worked for a public utility, that they're somehow not able to do their job. And let me finish. Mm-hmm. And my concern with that thrust of your argument is that there's a whole nother theory out there that says if you have the folks that are regulating so tied in with that, it's utility capture. And they then just, you know, had the mindset of the utility, which is a monopoly provider, right? And monopolies, you know, we know throughout history, monopolies need to be carefully regulated. So I'm very concerned with that thrust of your argument. And I would love to hear, if the PUC is here, some comments from them.
Representative, we can go there. We are a little bit limited on that some time. Our hope was that we could just hear from the presenter, but we could. I mean, if PUC Fair wants well. To come before us, that'd be fine. So
maybe I could take it, and then I'll turn it over to Secretary Bull. Is that okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Kraft?
Judge Lippman.
Okay, and so my rejoinder, Representative Kraft, is I absolutely want the PUC to do their job, and I think their job is a policy job, which is, as a policy matter, where do we want to end up on rates? I think that they're absolutely qualified to do that. The more granular kind of stuff that they're involved with in very expensive litigation is, you know, I think inappropriate because I don't think that they're in a position, frankly, even with the, you know, 80 staff people, to substitute their judgment for a much more complicated enterprise. And I think, actually, it's an expensive and fool's errand. If they stuck to the policy, again, like SBI, the SBI folks aren't running a hedge fund. They're contracting with them, and only the best ones based upon market metrics. I think that they, just in the same way that the SBI controls the Wall Street power, I think that they can address and effectively regulate against abuses of monopoly power by measuring Xcel and the other 9 regulated utilities against market metrics, which are widely available. In public utilities, fortnightly, a couple of subscriptions to where the others are on rates and rates of return, I think would answer a lot of these questions and avoid a lot of litigation.
Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing me up. I will be really brief. I've known Eric Lippman for decades, my responses to some of what he wants to say aren't personal. He makes an analogy between the State Board of Investment and the PUC in that we both oversee organizations with huge assets, but and SBI does their work at less cost than the PUC and Commerce together. I'm disappointed, though, that Mr. Lippman thinks the work we do to oversee these essential services of natural gas and electric service that impact the lives of every Minnesotan in their homes and businesses every day And that, frankly, if the utilities don't do a good job providing, people can die, which happened in Winter Storm Uri a few years ago. That work is not anywhere analogous to the folks at SBI, besides the fact that we have both have three-letter acronyms in our refer to our agencies. I think I want to point out that our primary budget constraint isn't the 216B62 that Mr. Lippman pointed out. It's actually the appropriation that you give us every 2 years. So we can only spend the money that you have appropriated to us. We do charge that back to the utilities and then back to the ratepayers, and we pay back the general fund for that appropriation. But 216B62 is not the budget constraint that Mr. Lippman points to. It feels like that one of the things Mr. Lippman is saying is that if we put fewer resources into policing utility costs, and some of the questions I've heard so far, you have that impression too, that if we put fewer resources into policing utility costs, that somehow that drives better outcomes for ratepayers than we're currently achieving. I did point out to you that we've reduced utility rate requests by over $1 billion, and whether you think that's a phony baloney number or not, but if it's half that amount, it still swamps the amount of resources that you give us to do the work that we do. Our appropriation is $13 million a year. And if we saved $500 million, then that's still a good return for your ratepayers. And if I was following his argument correctly, every time that we reduce a utility's rate request, he thinks that reduces our ability to charge for our work, and that's just not how it works. So all that said, I appreciate Mr. Lippman's involvement in this conversation. We need more and more creative voices on how we do the work we do. If we have good ideas on how to do our work better and more efficiently, we're all ears. I haven't actually seen any of those ideas yet in any of the materials Mr. Lippman has posted to his YouTube channel or even much today in his testimony, but we hear recommendations, you hear recommendations from numerous parties and stakeholders all the time about how we could do better, and I think we want to bring those ideas forward. You mentioned the performance-based rate making statute. I worked past that legislation a few years ago. And we're not abandoning performance-based rate making. One of the things we just recently opened a new docket to focus on service quality for Xcel Energy and how we could use performance rate making to target better service quality outcomes for customers. So I think I could
Rep. Jones. There.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for providing your perspective on this. I will just say that performance-based rate making, I am very intrigued by that and encouraged to hear that there are further dockets continuing that work. And if there are any policy things that we need to do to continue that, please let us know. Another thing I wanted to mention, just like it came into my head comparing these two, the SBI and the PUC, is the PUC is a quasi-judicial agency, and so I would expect there to be lawyers. I just like, and maybe not as many as what you're saying there, but I would expect that. I did have a question about just a clarification. You had said that utilities. So I guess my question is, can utilities bill for rate cases? So essentially the work and the time that they've done, they've put in, they bill in that, and they put that into their rates.
Mr. Chairman.
Job Lippman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yes, absolutely. And just by using the example of the Xcel Natural Gas case, they've set aside nearly $1 million for these expenses in their most recent case. These are a lot of money. And I think actually that's an underestimate. Their last rate case was $1.5 million of expenses needed to talk to the government. I think that that's a good place to start for trying to reduce costs. With respect to Secretary Bull's argument about the importance of the PUC, absolutely. And lives are, in fact, in the balance. The question is, would we ever send 24 lawyers in order to do life-saving work? They're poor first responders. Super expensive, not the best way to try and serve folks on these important issues. I think we can do better. If we're creative and we work together and all of the voices are singing in harmony, I think we can actually lower the price point of government and do the kind of service that would make you most proud.
Rep. Jones, follow up.
Yes, thank you. Do you know of any states in which utilities are not allowed to bill for, or essentially include, build into their rates the rate cases work?
Judge Lippman.
This would probably be more Secretary Bull's expertise. In fact, I don't. I'm, again, I am fairly new to this, at least the financing piece. I was more on the litigation side. But again, mindful of our own statute on performance-based rulemaking, I think this is not science fiction. It's very much in the present art. We just need, I think, the kind of legislative encouragement to move at a faster rate on these kinds of issues. I'm delighted to hear about the Commission's docket on service levels. Absolutely. That's the direction we need to go, because I think we can express where we want to end up and don't necessarily have to hire legions of lawyers in order to get there.
Rep. Jones.
Thank you for that. I just have one follow-up comment. Specifically, when you were talking about the small natural gas companies, they don't want to grow past 5,000 members. I would just like to point out that, you know, if this were a conversation 20 years ago, I think that would be a more valid conversation. But now with heat pumps, with the technologies that we have available, it's just much more cost effective. If we're saying that delivered fuels, propane, things like that are too costly, electrification is much more cost effective. And so I want to put that on the table.
All right. Representative Ake, are you good? Okay. Sounds good. Thank
Chairman
you.
And members.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you for the time.
All right, next up, the next item of business, we have a presentation from Bill Glahn from the Center of the American Experiment. He'll talk about affordability. Mr. Glahn is joining us remotely. Mr. Glahn, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your presentation.
This is Bill Glahn. Can you hear me?
We can hear you, but we cannot see you.
Yeah, I noticed that. I'm
We're working on
trying to figure out how to activate my camera. Let's start video, see if that does anything for us. Well, let me go ahead and get started here while my computer continues to balk at me. Oh, there I am.
We can see you.
In all my glory, for better or worse, there I am. So I don't have any handouts prepared, but I will be referring to some documents that maybe you could follow along from your desk there. I know everybody has a laptop. I'm going to talk about affordability, energy affordability. And I guess I have the privilege and good fortune to be on here on the agenda behind Judge Lippman, because I think I can address some of the items that have come up here during this discussion, during the presentation from the judge, and during the discussion from members. And I'll try to incorporate in what otherwise would have been my presentation that I pre-prepared. Talking about affordability, where Minnesota ranks, and specifically electricity, but also talk a little bit about natural gas. Because they both work together, and the delivered fuels idea came up during the discussion as well. So Minnesota currently ranks 22nd in terms of the highest electric prices in America among states. Those are average prices for an entire state, and Minnesota ranks 22nd overall highest prices. In other words, that means that most U.S. states have average electric prices lower than Minnesota. In fact, all this data is from the Energy Information Administration, EIA.gov. It's a U.S. agency under the Department of Energy. And they do a lot of data crunching, collecting, processing, and that's my go-to source for energy data. And so they just, this Tuesday, came out with a report that covered all of calendar year 2025. So these numbers are of calendar year 2025, comparing all 50 states among each other and the District of Columbia. So Minnesota is higher than the median electric price. I'll tell you a little bit about, I'm getting the statistics here. Might have to remember back to high school and college statistics, the difference between the mean, the average, and the median. The average price is higher than the median price in America for electricity, and that's driven by a couple of outliers. There is a handful of states that have extremely high prices, and they're pulling up the average price. And those are Hawaii, California, Massachusetts, and a couple of other New England states as well. And California in particular drives up the average because it's a huge state and they have much, much higher than the median prices. And so Minnesota average electricity price across all customer groups, that's residential, commercial, industrial, all the other customer groups, when you average that number together for Minnesota and the way they, what items they include in that, EIA number comes to 12.67 cents per kilowatt, a little under 13 cents per kilowatt, and that is for calendar year 2025. And so, again, that ranks above the states that are ranked. About 27, 28 states have lower rates than Minnesota does. But Minnesota's below the average because California, Hawaii, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Massachusetts pull up the average so much it has skewed the average. But we ended up being a higher than average state, and that's not good. And it's interesting if you look at which states are above us, which states are below us, who ranks where, it's almost as if we've been conducting a controlled experiment, which is something we don't do in economics or public policy very much, controlled experiments where you have states pursuing their own energy policies, and we let it go for a few decades and let it shake out, and what are the results? It is amazing how it breaks down blue versus red. You look at the top six states for electricity prices, Hawaii, California, the New England states I mentioned, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. You throw all those together, every one of those has a 100% renewable energy mandate. So all the states that have renewable energy mandates just happen to be in the top six. There are other states that have mandates too, but the top six, the ones that are pulling the average above the median, all have 100% renewable energy mandates. So we've been conducting this controlled experiment, and I would say the results are in. The states that have followed this progressive, renewable-heavy energy policy have ended up with the highest electric prices in America. And you look at the states that have lower prices than Minnesota, they're almost all what we would call red states. There are states that have not been pursuing as aggressively these renewable energy policies. And a couple of notable exceptions, the two states that have very blue politics but very low electricity prices are Oregon and Washington State, which are in the Pacific Northwest, and they enjoy very low electric prices because they have a huge amount of hydropower, cheap, low-cost hydropower that drives down their unit cost. So they end up still having low electricity prices, even though you would think of them as very blue states. Otherwise, with a couple of exceptions, Virginia, my home state from way back when, is among the lower electric prices, former coal state. So you do have a couple of exceptions, but with those exceptions, those dozens of states are all red states and have lower electricity prices than us. And so EIA breaks up the country into regions, and they, for whatever purpose, put Minnesota in what they call the West Central region. So the EIA groups the West Central states, Minnesota, the Dakotas, going through Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri. And that's the West Central region, and Minnesota is lumped in with those states. Among those states, Minnesota has the highest electric prices, and it's not a close second. So all these states to our west and south, the Dakotas, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, all have lower prices. And I heard the subject come up of public power. Someone suggested public power might be a way, that is consumer-owned utilities or government-owned utilities might be a way to lower electricity prices. I would note that in the West Central region, the region includes the only state in America that has 100% public power. The state of Nebraska, all electricity is produced by government consumer-owned utilities. There are no investor-owned, private, shareholder-owned utilities in Nebraska. They do not have the lowest prices in the region. The utility, the state with the lowest prices in the West Central region is our neighbor to the west, North Dakota. They are not a public power state. They have consumer-owned utilities, but they also have several utilities that we share in Minnesota. We have several Minnesota utilities, utilities headquartered in Minnesota that also serve large swaths of North Dakota. And it's very interesting that we have these same utilities, these same investor-owned utilities operate on both sides of the Red River. Minnesota has the highest price in the West Central region. They have a higher price than 27 other states. North Dakota has the lowest prices in the region. And other than Idaho, which is another Pacific Northwest state, North Dakota has the lowest electricity prices in America. So it's almost, again, another controlled experiment. We have the same utilities operating on both sides of the border, but we have very different results in terms of price per kilowatt hour. And the only difference really is public policy. The state of North Dakota, its Public Service Commission, the state of Minnesota, its legislature, and Public Utilities Commission have adopted very different policies around electricity production and distribution and use. The same companies operate both sides of the border and very different price results. So it's as if America, the Midwest, have been conducting a controlled experiment, and we adopt different policies for electricity in each state and produce very, very different results. So I want to talk a little bit about another measure that people tell me about is something we should use to compare states, and that's the size of your monthly bill. Sorry about that. Yes, we all pay monthly electric bills. I pay a monthly electric bill, and that's what we talk about when we talk about bills. Oh, I paid $100 a month. I paid $200 a month, whatever it is. When you're talking to your neighbors or your colleagues at work, you don't talk about what price you pay for kilowatt hour, unless you're like me, used to work for a utility, and that's what you do. But everybody's focused on their bill because that's what they have to write the check for every month. And when you look at that measure, the average price, or sorry, the average monthly bill per state across America, Minnesota doesn't fare as badly as it does on the price per kilowatt measure. And if you look at the highest monthly bill per consumer in each state, is actually Connecticut is number one. They have the bad fortune of being one of the highest price states, but not as high as Hawaii. And the difference comes down to uses of electricity. How do consumers use electricity in their states? And what happens is some of the highest bill, monthly bill numbers come from some southern states because they use electricity for winter heating, as well as summer cooling and all the other uses you use electricity for. And for the most part, people in the Great Lakes states use natural gas for heating. It's very cold in Minnesota and other Great Lakes states. They have turned to natural gas as a primary heating fuel in addition to the delivered fuels of propane and fuel oil. Speaking of fuel oil, that's still a dominant fuel in the northeastern states, which would include Connecticut, but basically New York City, New York, New Jersey, up through New England. But Minnesota is one of those states that uses natural gas for primarily winter heating, some cooking and other uses. And when you take that usage out of your electric bill, you end up with a much smaller electric bill. So a more fair comparison would be total energy usage per household, not just the electric bill. And as it happens, we talked about this a little bit, the average end price for consumers for natural gas in Minnesota is one of the lowest in the country. It's the exact opposite of the electricity story. So we have, it's actually ranked 42nd in America, which is quite low, even lower when you consider the fact that some states don't really have natural gas service, and some other states have so little that the EIA doesn't bother ranking them. So among the 43 states that the Energy Information Administration ranks in terms of cost per therm, Minnesota ranks only above Idaho, again, as one of the lowest states. So we have a very low cost, relatively low cost fuel in natural gas being the state's primary heating service. And then electricity for the other uses ends up looking like a low per household bill for electricity, but that's an artifact of how we heat our homes. And southern states who have winter down south too and heat with electricity, they end up having a higher But we were talking a little bit on the committee here this morning, or sorry, this afternoon, about electrification. If you do continue to pursue that, well, you're going to destroy your monthly bill advantage. If you start heating with electric, even with higher efficiency fuel pumps, you start cooking with electricity, you ban natural gas. Some states have tried that approach, banning natural gas appliances, new homes, just trying to get rid of natural gas entirely because it's CH4, it's a carbon fuel. You are going to have extremely high electric bills because you are electrifying everything else. And so you're switching consumers from a fuel in which Minnesota has a decided advantage, natural gas, to a fuel in which Minnesota lags the nation, electricity, and you're going to end up with sky-high bills and much poorer consumers as a result. So a little bit of tour of affordability. If this is a real concern, then we see with these controlled experiments between Minnesota and North Dakota, other states in the West Central region, other states in America where you have a very different result depending on the politics of the state. You know, the region to our east, EIA, includes the what we think of as Midwestern states around the Great Lakes. And again, the lowest prices per kilowatt hour in the region to our east, the East Central region, are in Indiana and Ohio. So if you look at the politics of it, it almost completely determines the result if your goal is lower prices per kilowatt hour. So that's my tour of the affordability data landscape, and just what can we do about policy-wise. Something I've been advocating for years and I fought against when I was working at the legislature was the passage of the renewable energy mandate, the 100% carbon-free mandate. You see, wherever it's been tried, prices have gone up and not down. You would think at this stage of the game where we've been promoting renewable energy for the last couple of decades, if renewable energy truly were low cost, then the states pursuing it would eventually end up with lower prices. And that's just not the case. And really, it's an artifact of some bad analysis of price. You think of wind and solar as being cheap because the fuel cost, the sunshine, the wind, is essentially zero. But what you're doing when you invest in renewable energy, you are trading fuel cost for concrete and steel. So all of the infrastructure, the fixed cost of building a windmill, putting it in the landscape, putting up solar powers, you're paying for it all up front, and the lower cost of fuel never gets made up for over time. The equipment just doesn't last long enough for you to come out ahead, even with zero cost fuel. And what you're doing with wind and solar is also substituting the cost of added transmission, more transmission lines to hook up these facilities to the grid. You're trading fuel costs for transmission costs. The transmission costs never get associated with wind and solar, but they all filter down to that bottom line monthly bill that I talked about that consumers pay, and that's what they really care about. So at the end of the day, renewable energy, even though it has zero fuel cost, has too high a cost to make up for itself over the life of the investment. You pay for it, and historically I've paid for it through taxpayer-paid incentives, which some of those have been phased out. But again, that doesn't figure in your electric bill, so people have the wrong idea about the relative cost of different ways of producing electricity. And I think I'll cut it off there to allow for questions rather than continue to go on and on.
Thank you, Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the speaker for giving us an opportunity to talk about this. I honestly don't know what to say to even start because there's just so much that I think is unfortunately misleading. First, I want to start with when we think about our energy system, we don't only value the affordability, we also value the safety, the reliability, that it is serving our needs. And so just looking at one component, even in our current statutes, we don't only look at affordability. That being said, affordability is really important. And another thing I want to point out is that correlation does not equal causation. The states that he pointed out that have 100% clean electricity laws, he pointed out Hawaii, Theirs is only a few years old. They currently still power their generation, they generate their electricity from 67% fuel oil. So of course that's going to be really expensive. They have to ship it to an island. In California, they've been dealing with wildfires, so there's a lot of expense that has been coming to the utility system because of that. So I think just this impugning that the cause of the higher prices in some of these states that also happen to have 100% clean electricity laws is that their prices are only coming from that is a bit disingenuous. I'll also say that I would challenge the presumption that clean energy is not cost effective when the EIA, so he mentioned the EIA a number of times, that clean energy is not cost effective. Well, then why is the EIA predicting that 93% of the new generation that is going to be built this year or predicted to be built this year is going to be clean energy? Storage, wind, solar, things like that. And then I'll end with, the speaker also mentioned that Minnesota has an advantage with natural gas. We have zero fossil fuels in our state. Every therm of natural gas that we use, we have to import. And therefore, we are paying someone else for that therm of natural gas. And so I think that there were a lot of numbers thrown out trying to make the point that affordability should be the only thing that we should be focusing on. But there's a lot of data that I think refutes a lot of what the speaker has been talking about. Thank you.
Representative Buck.
Mr. Chair, may I have an opportunity to respond?
Well, I already called on Representative Buck, so sorry.
Thank you, Chair. I have a concern and a question in where we would include the costs for the health and environmental impacts to the ratepayers. Should that be part of the affordability? In my mind, I think it should be. We can't just always think about the dollar amount. There has to be other factors that are included in the affordability, because ultimately our health and the environment we pay for in one way or another, depending on how healthy we are, how healthy the environment is. So where should those things be included in the affordability factor?
Mr. Glahn.
Mr. Chair, well, I guess I'll start by responding to the previous rep's questions around affordability. Again, more numbers. The EIA published some numbers actually on Monday of this week talking about utility company retirements of fossil fuel plants, coal and natural gas. So in 2025, it was estimated, utilities had announced that they were going to reduce the amount of the fleets by something on the order of 12 gigawatts of, again, mostly coal and natural gas power plants. They had announced they were going to shut down 12 gigawatts last year. They shut down less than five. And the reason why they shut down less than half of what they had announced they were going to shut down, you cannot operate the system on renewable energy. So we talk about things other than affordability. Reliability is one of my biggest concerns. There is a certain share, as much battery power as you want to put on a system, you are going to you will be unable to operate it reliably. You will have to shut the grid down. You will have blackouts, rolling blackouts. So you have to have some amount of power that can be operable 24/7, some amount of power that can be dispatched on demand, which is mostly natural gas. Otherwise, the system is almost impossible to operate. You've seen that in places like Spain and Australia that have had adverse events where they had too much renewable energy on the line. Some of it dropped off unexpectedly. They couldn't ramp up other assets quickly enough, and then they had widespread, almost nationwide blackouts. So you need a certain amount of dispatchable resources on the system to operate it effectively. And I don't want to point fingers at anybody, but I would point out that our 2040 plan, our 2040 plan to operate on 100% carbon-free, which includes our new plants, still includes 20% natural gas. 100% carbon-free still includes 20% of its mix on a carbon fuel, natural gas, because you need it for reliability purposes. So we have this phenomenon where we're shutting down coal and natural gas plants, and we can't shut them down because we need them for reliability, because you can't operate the system without it. Batteries are nice. Batteries are expensive. Batteries buy you another 4 hours. They cannot run for days. So they discharge, and you got to ramp them up. And you mentioned, yes, all of the capacity, almost all of the capacity being brought online, other than a few small natural gas plants, are renewable energy, mostly wind and natural gas. Because in states like Minnesota, it's essentially all you're allowed to build. So people build what they're allowed to build. They're not allowed to build coal plants. Very difficult to build natural gas plants. So people build what they can build to keep the lights on. But it doesn't mean the market is driving that. It doesn't mean economics is driving that. Doesn't mean engineering, physics, or chemistry is driving that result. It's politics. It's policy. It's not driven by data. So, you know, you can say, hey, wind and solar, they have their advantages, and they do, but it's not something driven by economics or the market. As for the externalities of health costs and all that, as the one rep pointed out, we actually don't manufacture much electricity in this state. The health cost we've imported from other states. And that's something explicitly that utility regulators look at when they're setting rates. I don't know if Judge Lippman is still here, but externalities and environmental costs are explicitly built into rates.
Representative Buck, follow up. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Externalities are built into the rates. Would the externalities of climate change be built into those rates, Mr. Glahn?
You know, again,
Mr. Glahn.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. It's been a while. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Again, we've been debating this for decades, long before I was a Deputy Commissioner of Commerce, long before I was on the House staff. We've been debating how best to deal with externalities of climate change. Should we have a carbon cost? Should we add a dollar amount, put our thumb on the scale? I don't think we've come to any consensus. And if you're an economist, you fear there's probably some way of doing it, but it would not account for the differential in prices between these states. Those are other policy decisions that are driving votes.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I was just asking a yes or no question. I think your answer was no. Look, Mr. Glahn, you threw out a lot of numbers in a lot of different ways. And what I really object to with you coming in and giving the kind of discussion you did was that there was no slides. There's no ability to go back and look at some of the things that you said. I think it is irresponsible to have the kind of presentation you just did and not have something for us actually to look at to try to respond on these things that you're just throwing out with nothing we can look at. So to the extent you come back at some future point, I would ask you to be more prepared. A couple other points I'd make. There's quite a bit of cherry picking going on in your data. You talked about, well, Minnesota's below the average, and I think I need to explain away why that is. That's because there's a bunch of states that are above the average. Well, let's pull out the ones that are below the average as well. I mean that's why it's the average. And if you're pulling out some of those are averages where there's a lot of population as well. So the cherry picking was interesting. I will point out when we had commerce in last week that I think the thing that really matters is what is the energy burden? What portion are people paying of their personal consumption on electricity? And that is going down, even in a time when our electricity usage is going up. You threw out a bunch of states, and again, it was hard to get it all down, but many of the states you mentioned that you said have lower average prices than we do, have more wind than we do. North Dakota in particular, 40% wind versus 25% in Minnesota. So again, I'm just trying to like stay up with this flow of information coming from you. The last thing I will say is if you talk about clean energy in your comment that it's not cheaper, yes, I agree with you. There's an upfront cost. You explain away, say, oh, the fuel cost doesn't matter. Well, you know what? Where the fuel cost really matters? Inflation, right? When you don't have a fuel cost, you don't have inflation caused by wildly varying prices of fossil fuels. And on a on a let's just look at the market. The clean energy market globally is growing from $1.4 trillion to $2.5 trillion over the next several years. So why is that happening? That's, you know, whatever you, you know, whatever our, and many of this growth in the United States is happening in places like Texas and Iowa. So renewable energy is the cheapest form of new electricity. That is what the market is showing us. So I'd rather, I appreciate having a debate on this stuff, but come in with some data that we can actually track.
Mr. Glahn?
No, thank you. Okay. Yes, I'd be happy to send something for the committee to distribute with links to where I got all this stuff from. So if there's an interest in that, I'm happy to. I threw out lots of numbers. I'm happy to give you the links. You can double check my work. Again, 90% of it was from the EIA website, which you're all familiar with. So I would like to address a couple of the points you made. Yes, North Dakota ranks very high in terms of renewable energy production, and Minnesota is paying for it. So it's Minnesota-driven policy that's being implemented in North Dakota, Iowa, and elsewhere. So we have exported our energy policy to states that are better able to accommodate. It's much windier in North Dakota than it is in Minnesota. It's windy in Minnesota, but it's windier in North Dakota. Places like Kansas rank very high in energy production for renewable energy, Texas as well. But they're not bearing much of the cost. Much of the cost is being borne by people who are also on the grid, who are subsidizing this through their electric rates. And these facilities are not owned by local consumer-owned utilities. They are good capitalists in other states taking advantage of our good faith efforts to pursue policies that I don't agree with. But again, it's follow the money. So the North Dakota, lots of wind power. North Dakotans have some of the lowest prices in America, and it's not because of Minnesota's energy mandates.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Glahn. You know, I've seen a lot of your data over the years, and one of the things that I think would be interesting, this is about affordability, and if we are adding new power, which we're going to have to do, I remember seeing information from you where you talked about the cost of each type of fuel or energy, and you looked at it under the scope of added infrastructure and also just the life of the asset. But I remember the numbers that you talked about for each one. Do you recall some of the numbers that it takes as far as generating electricity on a megawatt for hydro, coal, natural gas? Do you remember some of the numbers that you used? Because it was pretty telling.
Mr. Glahn? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that in front of me, and I would hesitate to throw out numbers that I don't have in front of me for fear of getting it wrong and then being accused of acting in bad faith. So, but just from memory, the qualitative differences between the two of you. You have a nuclear power plant, super expensive to build up front, massive multi-billion dollar upfront costs, but they last 40, 50, 60, 70 years. So you're spreading those costs, you're amortizing those costs over a very long period of time. And this was my one of my complaints about wind and natural gas, wind and solar, is that solar panels, you know, are only at the vagaries of hailstorms and wind events where their life expectancy might be measured in a decade or two, or wind power, same sort of thing. A windmill is going to last you 10, 15, 20 years. It's not a half century or three quarters of a century over which you can amortize those costs and take advantage of that low-cost fuel year after year, decade after decade. You have a windmill, you have a wind farm where you're replacing your units every couple of decades. Yeah, the fuel cost is zero, but now you've renewed your entire capital base twice, three times in the lifetime of a natural gas plant or a nuclear plant. So again, when you're comparing apples to apples, these levelized costs over the lifetime of the equipment, what might look like a good decision on the front end over the life of an asset, and I haven't even brought it up to end of use, trying to dispose of solar panels, or you've all seen the photo of those wind turbine blades in that South Dakota landfill, the end of life disposal cost. You know, it ends up flipping the decision in the other direction when you look at it from a life cycle basis.
Representative Murphy, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just say that the numbers that were shared at that time were pretty interesting. I do remember the numbers because I wrote them down and talked about them often. So 27 cents per or dollars per a megawatt was natural gas. 35 is coal. 37 is nuclear. And that's for when you're looking at unsubsidized. And that's the part you need to look at over the life of the asset. We need those types of numbers. So I'd encourage you to bring that information back. But that was pretty telling, and I remember that that's something that I used a lot. But we need to know what the cost of added electricity is going to cost. And it is about electricity. My dairy farmers that have a $1,000 light bill, if we end up like California, their light bill is going to be $5,000 a month, not $1,000. That's why we need to make sure these numbers are right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do want to make sure that there's a correction. So when I said that there was 93% of the expected new generation is clean, that's not Minnesota. That's the United States. So as you were talking about that this is all being driven by policy, I mean, this is policy from 50 different states. These are different utilities, many capitalist-driven, and they are seeing that the cheapest way of providing new power is through clean energy. The other thing, as we were talking about the levelized cost of energy, so Lazard is the pinnacle. It is what is known, like everyone looks to Lazard for their levelized cost of energy. And so I was literally just looking up those numbers, and I, Representative Murphy, I would maybe challenge and make sure that we're looking at the most recent data because it's very clear here. Solar is $29 and wind is $27, whereas gas plants are $110. I guess gas combined cycle is $45. So making sure we have the most up-to-date data is really important.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the lively discussion, and appreciate the comments being made. I just, I do appreciate that we're talking about affordability in terms of energy, and, want to point out that, as we heard earlier this week, was it this, I don't know, we heard recently, about the extension of coal plants after they were expected to be turned off, and the cost that that's going to cost all of us here in Minnesota, and the $42 million is what I recall being the extra charges to ratepayers here in Minnesota because of coal plants being kept open in other parts of the country. And so as we look at affordability, I hope you can look at federal policies being implemented to impact all of us. And I just want to correct a little bit of the comments you said in terms of lifespan of renewable equipment and return on investment. My solar panels are expected to pay themselves back within or pay off that initial investment within 8 years, and solar panels will last 25 to 30 years, not 10 years, not 15 years. And the same thing with wind turbines. And so I appreciate that we can, try to hedge to make things sound better, but let's look at the reality of the situation. And so with that, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Okay, sorry.
You talked about it.
Thank you, Chair. Unfortunately, I missed most of the presentation. I was out talking to constituents. But one thing I think that I haven't heard folks talking about is when we're talking about affordability, like we tend to think of things as in silos, and we're saying, what is the energy affordability? But the reality is we need to be thinking about this in a million different ways, because we know that the health committee is dealing with people who have increased rates of asthma for children, and that's because of climate change. We know that insurance rates are going up across the country, and that some people aren't even able to get insurance anymore because of climate change and the constant flooding and storms that are impacting them. We know that infrastructure costs are going up because as climate change comes through our state, rivers are flooding areas, bridges are going out, streets have to be rebuilt again and again and again because of the freeze-thaw cycle. So as we think about affordability, it is, yes, the energy cost, but it's also everything else that goes along with that energy cost. And I frankly think it's a little irresponsible for us to only talk about the immediate cost to individuals, because the folks who end up bearing those other costs aren't thinking about whether it's a coal plant or it's a wind turbine, right? They're thinking about their kids and whether or not they can afford to get them their medication, whether they can afford to have asthma, whether they can get their house insured. And we're passing the buck onto regular citizens when we make this argument that coal plants are better than renewable energy. In my mind, and I know in many cultures, we are thinking generations ahead, not just about how it impacts our pocketbook right now, but how do we make sure that we are keeping the people of Minnesota safe, secure, healthy, and in their homes. And one of the ways that we do this is by making sure that we're tackling the problem of climate change. So I think that whenever we have these conversations, we have to think about a bigger picture. It is not right for us to think about this in a silo. Less of a question, more of a comment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. Thank you, Mr. Glahn. For your presentation, we do have some other, I think in the packet, there might be something from American First Prosperity, a packet of some information. You can look it up, and Mr. Glahn, when you share that, whatever information you might have, we'll share that with the committee. We appreciate your time. And with that, any other questions? We're good? All right. Representative Mecklen, would you like to approach the testifying table? The bill on the agenda is House File 3298. Representative Mecklen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3298, there is an A3 amendment I'd like to do now.
Would you like to move your bill first, and then we can...
I'll move the bill, yes. The bill will be, the motion is to move it to Ways and Means.
Yes, all right. Representative Mecklen moves that House File 3298 be... referred to the House Committee on Ways and Means. To your bill or to your amendment?
To my amendment. The amendment is actually just a technical amendment on some verbiage and some statute numbers, so it's really nothing to explain.
All right. Representative Mecklen makes a motion to the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he would like. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? The favorables have it. Representative Mecklen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have two testifiers here. I will just briefly explain what this is. It's been ongoing for a while. The underground piping that's in the ground was old 90s technology. It was best at the time. Things have changed since then, so I'll let these two gentlemen explain all the really exciting, spicy details.
All right. Mr. Gross or Mr. Kelly, would you please introduce yourself and go on with your testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tim Gross. I'm the Executive Director of Fueling Minnesota. We're a 100-year-old trade association that represents the 400 licensed fuel markers who own and operate the majority of the Minnesota's 2,500 convenience stores, truck stops, and retail fueling sites. Our members are primarily multi-generational family businesses and farmer-owned cooperatives located throughout the state. I am here in support of creating a new preemptive reimbursement option within the Minnesota Petroleum Tank Release Cleanup Fund, commonly known as the Petro Fund. The Minnesota Petro Fund is widely regarded as the gold standard in our country. It primarily helps the reimbursement cleanup costs after a petroleum spill or leak has already occurred. Because of the Petro Fund's financial support, releases are reported promptly, cleanups are completed quickly, and the Minnesota groundwaters are protected, all by keeping costs financially prudent. But we believe Minnesota can do even better by preventing releases before they happen. One of the highest risk pieces of an underground tank fueling system still in use in parts of the state is single-walled pressurized steel piping. This is a unique legacy issue in Minnesota. Based on our most recent data, approximately 38% of our retail fueling sites, roughly 500 locations statewide, still operate with this type of piping. While this piping was considered state-of-the-art when installed, it is corrosion-prone and may be vulnerable to failure due to environmental ground conditions. When failures occur, cleanup costs can easily reach hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. These costs ultimately fall on the Petro Fund, the fuel marketer, and Minnesota's fuel consumers. Our proposal is simple and fiscally responsible. Allow limited, targeted Petro Fund reimbursement for proactively replacing high-risk piping systems before a release occurs. This is not a giveaway. It is a smart investment. Every release we prevent protects groundwaters and soil, avoids business shutdowns, reduces emergency response costs, and saves the Petro Fund significant long-term dollars, creating real savings for Minnesota fuels consumers. Our members want to do the right thing. Many are small family-owned businesses. The upfront costs of replacing perfectly functional underground piping when there might be or could be a future problem with equipment can be a real financial barrier. Incentives are the key. This policy aligns incentives the right way. It encourages responsible upgrades, reduces environmental risk, and protects the long-term health of the Petro Fund by, in this case, preventing releases instead of reacting to them. This is good for the environment, good for small businesses, good for the Petro Fund, and good for Minnesota fuel consumers. Thank you for the time. I'm happy to answer questions.
Mr. Kelly, would you like to introduce yourself?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Vern Kelly. I've been in the petroleum business, sweeping the drive from my dad's gas station in Richfield 70 years ago. So I've been in this business a long time. I served 12 years as the Petro Fund chairman just coming off a year ago. And I want to make it clear that I'm not speaking for the current Petro Fund. I'm going to speak about observations for the 12 years I spent as chair of the board of the Petro Fund. I noticed over all the years that I served that prevention was always the cheapest way to handle a release. And so if we could somehow get the problem away before it actually happened, and whether it was inspections or whatever it was, that was the best way to handle it. The bill that we're offering here this morning has precedent. Years ago, we had a PCV pipe used in fuel oil houses that were heated with fuel oil as part of their infrastructure. Over a period of time, we saw a lot of leaks, releases coming from this PCV pipe that was breaking, that was leaking. And so we obtained legislation for the Petro Fund to fund getting rid of that PCV pipe before there was a problem. And there was a lot of money saved in cleanup because we were able to do that. Steel pipe is a problem in Minnesota. I was an observer in Alexandria, Minnesota at a convenience store a little over 2 years ago. The fellow operator there was a member of our Fueling Minnesota organization, and he invited us to come up because he was going to have an MPCA inspection, and he was a little worried about it. He had had a leak in his number one diesel tank that previous winter, and it shut it down, and the MPCA was going to come in and they were going to look over his site. And so we met up there, and the MPCA inspector showed up. He took all the dispenser covers off, and he got it, and this is a pressurized system, and he got his wire brush out, and he started with the number two diesel, started scraping on the underground piping that he could see under the dispenser. And it was fine, so he moved on to the unleaded and got his wire brush out and started scraping there. And sure enough, all of a sudden there was a leak. And then he moved to the mid-grade, took his wire brush, started scraping, and another leak. The operator was actually laying on the hood of his pickup crying because he was shut down. I was taking and bagging the nozzles as fast as I could, and his customers were coming in and they wanted to buy gas, and he couldn't sell it. So he shut everything down, and the reason I'm telling you this is because this is not an isolated case of what could happen. This could be an epidemic down the road, and our Petro Fund is basically a big insurance carrier insuring every tank in Minnesota. So every tank operator uses the petrol fund for his insurance. And so if you were running an insurance company and you knew that you had a big problem coming up as far as risk, you'd want to do something about it. And so that's what I think this whole bill is about, is prevention, about getting that pipe out of the ground as soon as we can. Certainly, everybody has a business plan within their convenience store and their operation. We want to hurry that business plan along. This is not a free ride here. The operator is going to have to pay to get payment from the Petro Fund. So it's not just free money. It's something he's going to have to do. But it's so important that we do this, that we go with the prevention route. Otherwise, we're going to, again, the Petro Fund is basically to ensure financial responsibility, but also the environment of the state of Minnesota, of our land and our lakes, our legacy properties that we own that distribute gasoline. We want to make sure that those are, the legacy is kept for our children. And so that's why we're here this morning. Scott Hawks is here from the Petro Fund. He's the operator of the executive director of the Petro Fund. And every year he has to file a report with the Region 5 EPA in Chicago that shows the financial responsibility of our Petro Fund, which is the best in the country. Tim Gross mentioned that, and I sat on a national organization for many years, and it is the gold standard of all the states. And so when he sends that report in every year, he has to show that our fund is financially responsible so that our tank owners can use it as their insurance policy. And if we get too many leaks, if we get too many expenditures against that fund, then it could go the other way. I'm here to tell you from my 12 years on the Petro Fund that this is a good bill. This is something we need to do. And I think it's going to save more money getting that pipe out of the ground than it is for in the cleanups we're going to have to do. So I think that we need to make sure that this gets done. And I appreciate your time listening to us this morning or this afternoon. And if you have any questions, we'd certainly be willing to answer them.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mickland, I appreciate the bill hearing today. Just wanted to ask about the availability of a fiscal note. Has one been requested? And what's the status of a fiscal note for the bill?
Representative Mickland or staff?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A fiscal note has been ordered, and we did also discuss with the gentleman, I guess his name is Scott, from the Petro Fund. The way this works, the Petro Fund dollars actually pays deeds administrative time or any other thing. So whatever cost this is going to incur, it's coming out of the Petro Fund itself. So it wouldn't be any general fund dollars. But it is one order, so it should be coming soon.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that response. I think we just like to see that in writing. So we look forward to seeing that, hopefully before the bill's next stop. Typically, we'd like to, I guess, have it before we leave committee, but we can certainly be flexible in terms of that. But looking for it.
All right. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mickland, a few questions. So in terms of how the Petro Fund works, and how, because this is going to be a broader use of it, require more money in the Petro Fund. My understanding is that is financed by a increase in the gas tax of some portion, or the 2 cent per gallon gas tax that funds the Petro Fund continuing for a longer period of time. Is that correct? Or am I missing that?
4 and 14, right?
Mr. Kelly?
Is it 4 and 14?
No.
Or Mr. Gross?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, we've had discussions with the Department of Commerce. It is a 2 cent, and it turns off and on when the fund gets to a certain level. And the last several years, or historically, it's about on about COP comes on about every 14 months, and then stays on for 4 months, and then we go another 14 months before it comes on. And what we determined, the $4 million a year would equal about coming on 1 month earlier.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So yes, it increases the gas tax somewhat for an additional month every few years or something like that, I believe.
The basic premise, yeah. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. The basic premise Macklin. Is instead of being on 4 months off 14, it'll be on 5 off 13 on an average.
Okay. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get it. And by the way, this seems like a responsible thing to do to make sure that the leaks don't happen. I learned of one situation where there was a pretty serious leak and it caused multiple, like got into the groundwater and things like that. That's the kind of thing that you want to avoid, correct?
Representative Macklin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just give you one little example, Representative Kraft. So recently in Minnesota, experienced one of these releases, and it's in Elgin, Minnesota. So if they would have had this $100,000, what do you call it, a grant, and had this done, now they're going to be, petrol funds going to be spending over $2 million to clean it up. So it would have been $100,000 in prevention versus $2 million for the cure.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Representative Macklin. Yeah, actually, that's the case I was referring to. And I think one of the real concerns was that it got into the groundwater, and that's one of the things that caused the additional expense. So I think we don't want our water to be polluted by this stuff. So I applaud trying to think forward about this. The question I would have is, and I appreciate the incentives. At the end of the day, will you get all of these with these incentives, or will there be some left after the period of this? What's your view?
Mr. Gross?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kraft, our expectations are, we figured there are about 500 sites, and this was numbers from about a year ago. Some things might have reduced by this time. By just time, our industry is shrinking, right, in the state of Minnesota. Our numbers aren't increasing. We expect probably we would help about 400. This is our numbers, pulling out of there. About 400 we'd probably help. And that's why we say $4 million a year and 100,000 for a year, and it sunsets after 10 years. So we figure 500 and 100 will probably disappear and close or just by normal process. Yep.
Representative Kraft.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Okay, that's good. I would encourage you to be thinking to make sure that at the end of this, there are none left, because the risk of the pollution of groundwater, I think, is something we don't want to take. And then the last thing I would say is my understanding is part of the thing that's causing corrosion prone, the part of the thing that causes additional corrosion is the content of ethanol in the fuel. That's one of the reasons that we have to upgrade the piping and have certain, because ethanol in the fuel, the higher the ethanol level is, the more corrosive it is. Am I right on that as well?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kelly.
Representative, it's my experience that the pipe corrodes from the outside, and it has to do more with the soil type, where sand will keep a pipe for many years, where clay will not. And so the ethanol at this point is not the problem. The problem is in the soil and the length of pipe the length of time that the pipe has been in the ground.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you.
I would like to clarify one thing. The fee. The fee is paid by the distributor. It's not a tax of any kind. It's put on the distributor's amount of money that he sends in every month. And so does a consumer pay or does a distributor pay it? I've been asked that many, many times over the 12 years I was on the petrol fund. And basically I have never seen the street price of gasoline go up the day that the fee goes on. The market sets the street price. It doesn't have anything to do with the fee. The fee could go on and there's no change in the price at the pump. And you won't see that. It's the way it is.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that point, that what your comment is that extra, we'll call them taxes, fees raised from someone in the middle doesn't necessarily increase the price at the end. I'll remember that. Thank you.
Representative Mecklen, you might want to say something there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kraft, I will say that Vern here used to own and operate Kelly Fields out of Shakopee. He recently sold it, and he was our supplier for many, many years. So I've known this gentleman for 30-some years now.
Just a secondary question. Did you have a follow-up? You're good. On my own, is the $100,000, is that expected to cover the entire cost of the retrofit, or is it going to be a percentage of the retrofit?
Mr. Chair,
Gross.
I appreciate that question. No, when we determine what the max would be working, what the petrol could afford, right, no, this will not even cover 50%. In fact, when we open the ground, we expect those operators, our members, will probably do many more upgrades above and beyond this, containment and upgrades to other components to the system because the ground is open. It's the best time to do it. So on an average, just replacing the piping was a year ago was $225,000, depending on the systems and the length of pipe and things like that. So we would expect we could see our members putting in out of their own pocket $800,000, $900,000 on this. $100,000 just getting them to get the ground open and start working on
the ground. So just as a clarification, it's not expected to cover the entire cost, just a percentage. Nope. All right, sounds good. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, excellent bill, proactive bill. I really support it. I'm just curious, what is the replacement for this single-walled pressurized line?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the current EPA MPA standards that we mentioned in our bill now require us to put in double wall piping with materials that are far above and beyond what we had back in the early 2000s and 1990s of steel. There's the material is different, same strength. We need something strong with our ground shifting in the wintertime. So we're looking at a double wall that's required with any upgrade we do when we break the ground. And that's with interstitial testing with our automatic tank gauges. So the problem what we're describing today will not happen with that type of system.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. And I notice in bill language, site improvements are not covered by this, but once you rip up concrete and go to the work of replacing your lines and such, your expenses do mount up greatly. So I think this bill with that $100,000 incentive to get this done is an excellent way to do it, and hope this bill can fast track, move ahead. Shouldn't need a fiscal note in terms of no cost to the general fund, so hopefully you're on your way.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the author, bill author. I just want to quickly say that I'm going to encourage our side to support this on the hope that the fiscal note comes back and we can have that conversation in Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative. Is there, before we move on, is there anyone from the public that would like to testify for or against the bill? Anybody? Anybody? All right. All right, Representative Mecklen, do you have any final comments?
Please vote yes.
Would you like to renew your motion?
Renew my motion to move 3298 as amended to Ways and Means.
Representative Mecklen renews his motion that House File 3298 be referred as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Ways and Means. Members, the next meeting we have is Tuesday. Representative Akam will have the gavel, and we look forward to that meeting. Seeing nothing else, this meeting is adjourned.